and welcome to New Books in Architecture. I'm your host, Kimberly Zarikor from Iowa State University. Today I'll be talking to Jeffrey Balmer and Michael Swisher, the authors of Diagramming the Big Idea, Methods for Architectural Composition, published by Routledge in 2012. In the book, they offer some new insights into the eternal problem of how creativity works. As you'll hear, they're beginning design instructors and colleagues at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte, where they teach architecture students how to communicate their ideas and concepts through diagramming. The material for this book developed out of their teaching and the realization that students and professionals needed more resources to nurture their design thinking skills and methods. Of interest to both architects and anyone who wants to know more about the design process, this book explains how and why diagrams work, provides examples of successful diagramming strategies, and offers step-by-step instructions on how to make your own diagrams in two and three dimensions. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Hi, Michael. Hi, Jeff.
Hello.
Hello,
Kimberly.
Hello, Kimberly.
Today we are speaking with Jeff Balmer and Michael Swisher from the University of North Carolina at Charlotte about their new book, Diagramming the Big Idea, Methods for Architectural Composition, that was put out this year by Routledge. And I'd like to start by asking you guys to tell us a little bit about yourselves. And Michael, you can go first.
Well, I've been teaching first-year design for a very long time. I have been at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte in what is now the School of Architecture for 25 years, with the exception of 3 years during which I ran the thesis program. I've been in first year design the entire time. It's what I like doing, and so that's who I am. My background is that I have an architecture degree, BA with a major in architecture from Washington University in St. Louis. I studied painting in Germany and received an MFA in interrelated media from Massachusetts College of Art back in 1980. My teaching career essentially amounts to teaching first year anything for a really long time at a lot of schools. I'm a painter. I actually made a living as a painter before I started teaching at University of North Carolina. And my interest in first year is because it allows me to re-examine the beginning of the knowledge of design, architecture, art, whatever it is, over and over again. That sort of appeals to me, takes on my philosophical side more than anything else. My contribution to our collaboration is that I come in with a fairly strong background in visual analysis, visual design, visual principles, and drawing, which of course forms the core of how I've always taught. And I lean on Jeff for being much more of an architectural thinker than I am. Architecture is part of a visual study for me as a whole. And I, without speaking for Jeff too much, I'd say that it's almost the inverse for him, which has been a perfect compliment. I think that's enough about me.
Thanks, Jeff.
Well, I'm a colleague of Michael's. I joined the faculty at UNC Charlotte 6 years ago, and I've been teaching with Michael in the first year program for four of the last 6 years. I'm originally from Toronto. I'm a graduate of the University of Waterloo, and I practiced for several years before returning to grad school. Was a student and then eventually a faculty member at Iowa State, where eventually I was a colleague of yours, Kimberly.
Yes.
And that brings me back here to UNC Charlotte. And that's it. That's all I have to say about myself.
Okay. So let's talk about the book. This is a different kind of book for our New Books Network. It's a book about teaching design. It's a book for students. It's a book for the general public. It's not a history, although it does have some historical content necessitated by the idea of the diagram. And I was particularly struck by your formulation in the introduction of a definition of architecture that says that architecture is organization toward a purpose. And I wonder if one or both of you could talk a little bit about how you came up with this definition and how it's driven your development of this whole book that's around the idea of the diagram.
Well, I suppose this is Michael. I suppose I should take blame for the for that definition. It arose a number of years ago when one of my students just asked in the room, "So, what is architecture?" And I put my philosopher's hat on and thought about it and realized that the one thing that architecture small a has is the notion of order built into it. That is, when we talk about the architecture of computers, when we talk about the architecture of a paradigm, all of that is relating to the notion of how something is organized. And the next step that comes in is it's organized to do something very particular or be something very, very particular. And so the simplest sort of 5-cent word for that is purpose. And then I think that the argument is that when architecture decides to put on a capital A and become our subject, that purpose starts to have a much more narrow focus, or helps to narrow the focus of the discourse. And so that's really the origin. The things that architecture tries to organize, whether it's space, whether it's form, whether it's material, all of that is in service to sort of a human purpose, and recognizing that in that sense, it stops being an object and becomes a kind of principle that's visible. Sort of clears for me away a lot of the detritus of buildings and what they look like. Instead, it starts to ask what do they really embody when they're going about being buildings or being architecture for human beings. After all, we can talk about landscape architecture and we don't have buildings there at all. So there must be some sort of correspondence between buildings as architecture and landscape as architecture and all sorts of things. And even urban design, I think, which is a sort of outgrowth of architecture. And so that's where that arose. Is that a reasonable?
Yeah, I think that's the origins of the definition. As far as this is Jeff. As far as the origins of the project, it was really a result of my role when I started was to follow. I was teaching the fall of second year, and my task was to follow what Michael and at the time Greg Snyder, who was a colleague of ours. Michael and Greg had developed this incredibly rigorous first year curriculum, and my task was to try and dovetail a follow up. And as a result, I was looking around for how to fit in what I had brought from my experience to something that was that matched the rigor of the first year curriculum that was in place. And so what I approached them with was, you know, what resources do you guys use to teach and to show students how to diagram? You know, I think there's this expectation among beginning design faculty that somehow we just expect students to know how to diagram. And my experience had always been that students just, you can't just do that. You can't just expect students to know. If you do that, then it's very trial and error. And what they told me is that Greg, in particular, I remember he recommended Douglas Graff's essay on diagrams. And, you know, if you've read that, you know that it's written at a very high level. But Greg had recommended it because it's one of the very few resources out there. So it was recommended out of a sense of, you know, sort of desperation. The other text that exists is the very, in many ways, very worthy book by Clark and Poss out of North Carolina State, Precedence in Architecture. But having examined it, you know, despite its apparent clarity to people who are practiced at looking at architecture, it's less than useful for beginning students because it depends upon a very practiced eye. And so what I then said to Michael and Greg and some of my other colleagues, I was teaching with another colleague, Peter Wong, at the time. I said, you know, there's nothing out there. It looks like, you know, this is a book that needs to be written. You know, there isn't a book that explains to students in simple terms how to go about diagramming. And that was the origins for the project. Michael explained very, very aptly the origins for the definition of architecture that begins the text. But that's the story that explains the origins for the project, the recognition that something along the lines that I think we produced just didn't exist. You know, there's also Frank Ching's books, but those are great as sort of Ching's books are great as references, almost as a sort of encyclopedia, something to turn to and almost a kind of manual. But we wanted to produce something that would you'd be able to follow as a kind of narrative.
This is Michael again, as if there was someone else in the room. But there are sort of two other threads that might help make add to that. Both of them are largely pedagogical. They have to do with what we expect to happen when we're teaching people. The model, unfortunately, for a lot of architecture schools, and this is something I think that is inherited. I don't think anybody started off to do this, is that the beginning design allows people to come in and get sorted out. And what I mean by that is it finds the folks who already have some kind of naive but present sense of visual order. And almost as if you were testing for the ability to hear pitch in a music program. Those who fall short of that are discouraged one way or the other from going on.
By attrition.
And so you have historically, and this is true of the schools I went to, these sort of horrid numbers of letting in 8 people and having 1 person graduate. It's almost as bad as law school, you know? And it seemed to me that that was not only sort of tragic, but it took the first year and it wasted it. Instead of teaching, the first year often becomes a kind of entrance examination. And precisely because there's this screening going on, it means that the pedagogical handoff from first year to second year is often, okay, here's who survived. God knows what they know, but they all seem to have what they what it takes. And you know, not wishing to spend my life as a teacher being a screen. And this is one of the things that we've accomplished at the university at our school is a fairly rigorous and attentive application process. This has been going on for a long time. And I think in the last 6 or 7 years, it's borne fruit because the pedagogy started to match the application process. But we really commit ourselves to our students. In other words, we don't let people in the room if we don't think they have some capacity to learn the stuff of architecture and of design. And then the task that comes for the first year is to make sure that everyone has the same skill at recognition of the elements of order. Secondly, they have sufficient facility at handling the tools of an architectural program, drawing, model making, and some intellectual skills as well, the ability to discuss things. This leads to hopefully the beginning of a sort of loop between recognition and facility. And begins that sort of iterative process that ultimately leads to their ability to talk about what they've done and to examine what they've done with a real critical eye. So the question is then, all right, how do you start that process? And the guiding principle that's in the book and also that comes directly from our teaching is to insist that nothing is knowable if you can't attach to something that you've done in architecture. In other words, visual recognition is not passive. It is the beginning of a process in which you actually make something, whether it's a simple drawing or a simple model. There is an attempt to build a very strong relationship between one's intentions and one's accomplishments. That is that doing really proceeds from thinking. And I'm borrowing here the language of the poet Auden, W.H. Auden, in an old essay of his called Thinking, Making, and Judgment, in which he really talked about writing poetry as an act, more than as a concept, and that this iterative process of seeing what you've done and developing a capacity to critique it, the building of what he calls an in internal censor, it goes on and on until you actually find yourself being able to look at your own work and seeing something that is unique and original, but also that has arisen from a kind of larger tradition. This is the bias of the program. This is what we keep trying to get better at. And so the first question is, what do we have to tell them to get them to do something so that they understand what they've done? It is saying in effect, we have to start with a blank screen, but we provide the elements in there. We don't wait to see what sort of nonsense the students have stashed in their little pocket. We start providing them some tools and some procedures and some language for looking at architecture. And this is where Jeff's insight, I think, has led us to use, finally, to take it out of the realm of that sort of visual training and moving it directly toward architecture with capital A, trying to ask the question, taking note of the notion that architects don't make buildings. They make drawings, they make models, they make instructions. And it's not too much of a jump to realize that those things, those representations of architecture, are in some sense always diagrammatic. Clark and Paz start with the building and then put an overlay of arrows, circles, black marks, whatever it is, in analysis of an existing building, that there's a design process in which you sort of accumulate diagrams, almost like a hologram. And at some point or another, you can actually imagine a real building inside of that diagram, so that there is, in a sense, an overlay of the diagram with the architectural act or the architectural experience that's not all that dissimilar from the pleasure of reading a book and recognizing that there's a thing called plot and character and subplot and all of those things we learn in English literature courses, or that coming out of a movie, we can actually analyze what's gone on in that film as a way of enriching our understanding. And in fact, that filmmakers have a language for describing that. And on with almost any anything that would be called a professional activity, something that's organized around a set of principles and actually proceeds from a tradition. What we have here in the book is an amalgam of that process, largely extracted from the teaching that we do, because it seemed to be rather successful, but pulling back one extra step and making sure that in absence of having us there in the studio, the projects were self-explanatory, to allow someone to begin to build that process of understanding for themselves outside of our studio.
Interesting to think about the change in architectural pedagogy that's happened recently, that we're finally moving away from a model that sort of cultivates the genius figure, you know, that we're all hunting for the next great designer, and instead says that architecture and other design fields are knowledge bases that we can teach and that students can learn, and that they don't have to come with the perfect eye and they don't have to come as the best artists in the room. But in fact, if we understand architecture as a form of organization of information or organization of purpose, that a lot of students who maybe historically hadn't thought of themselves as being the right kind of people to be architects could be brought into the field. And so not only is this project of yours to kind of think about pedagogy in a different way and offer tools for other people, a way of, you know, enriching teaching, but it's also in a sense opening up the discipline to more conversation and more people, and linking it to other disciplines that have already gotten to this point a long time ago. I mean, there's very few disciplines left out there that would say that what their job is to somehow cull out everyone who's not quite good enough and only hold on to the superstars. It's certainly not a model for success.
You're right. Absolutely. It's very contrary to the experience that I went through, where, you know, less than 50% of the classmates I started with finished. And it's quite striking, because now as a faculty member, we're going through a process now university wide where there are a series of initiatives designed to enhance
retention
among freshmen. And believe it or not, at our university, we as a department are considered a leading example of retention among freshmen. An mm-hmm. architecture school among the highest rates of retention among freshmen. Can you believe it? So
it's working.
It's a real sea change. And I think it's an example of, I think the way that architecture is going to have to adapt, not only do we feel it's a superior model, but the way that, you know, education, post-secondary education is changing, I don't think it's going to be viable to sort of hold on to the old way of having mass attrition as a sort of standard model as it has been in the past.
Definitely.
Let me extend on that. I can say this because I'm not a licensed architect, and I'm an architectural teacher, but my soapbox always sounds like this roughly, which is that the only people who understand architects are architects, then they have failed. It seems to me that this is not a secret handshake. You know, we're not some sort of group of Masonic cultists. All the Masons hate that. But, you know, instead of a secret handshake, that one of the things that we should be doing is saying, being able to say what we do in a simple enough way that ordinary people can appreciate it. And I use that word appreciate in the old-fashioned and correct sense of really understand it. You know, when people used to teach art appreciation, it wasn't like, I like that. That's not appreciation. It's, I understand that. That may perhaps be a fairly conservative approach, which I don't like the word conservative at all, But I think that it says something about the sort of shared prospect of architecture. You know, if we get upset that somebody wants to tear down a great building, we should recognize that in some sense we have failed as a practice to engender in folks a reason for maintaining good buildings other than nostalgia. It seems to me that this is really the big challenge in the future for architecture. You know, if it is really actually going to become something that fits within a kind of democratic view of the universe, then it has to drop some of its more comfortable elitism, which includes the sort of STAR program, right? Make itself clear and accessible and open the dialogue of what it's actually trying to accomplish so that it can actually talk about it.
I agree. We have our work cut out for us, but as we also agree, Michael, and as Peter Greenway has pointed out, you know, we have an additional challenge that it's not of our own fault that we live in a culture that where we spend almost our entire educational emphasis on understanding words and numbers, and we spend almost no time and effort on understanding visual information and visual knowledge. And so when we get students who start architecture school, design school, we're starting with essentially raw recruits. So architecture students, beginning design students in general, have a double challenge. And those of us that teach them have a double challenge. They're not only facing a new field, a new discipline, but they're also entering an entirely new field of knowledge or a new system of knowledge or a new language. It makes it doubly difficult than someone who might be starting a career in law, for instance, because they've spent their first 18 years reading, writing, and so forth. They understand the value of written language and the power of the word. A student starting the study of architecture has not had 18 years prior to that understanding, interpreting, appreciating the system of knowledge that is within the visual spectrum, or has received a very limited understanding of that entire spectrum. And so that puts architects at a disadvantage. And so making what architects do clear is of utmost importance, but it's an additional challenge to us, to fellow architects, because we don't live amongst a society that is given an equal background in terms of their general education. So the work that we have cut out for ourselves is additionally challenging. And so we have to work twice as hard, I think, to make people understand why the threat of a demolition for an important building is extra difficult for us to try and convey to the general public.
So let me bring that idea back to the book, because I think what you just articulated about language and building up the student's capacity to use this professional language is really reflected in the way that you organize the book. I think Clark and Paz, if I remember correctly, have more of a thematic way of thinking about things, that there are different types of diagrams and different groups of buildings, and we can use different diagrams to say different things about buildings. But your book is very different, because what you show in the book is that you have to start from somewhere in order to get somewhere else. And so it's a kind of building up of the language and knowledge base. And that's right, related to the way that you've organized the chapters. So why don't you guys say something about, you know, the setup of the book, the way that the general public might interact with it, the way that design teachers and students might, and, you know, how your philosophy of what your objectives are is reflected actually in the way that the book is put together.
Sure. This is Michael again. And I think the first thing that you encounter in the book, in fact, largely the first two chapters, are trying to sort of set up the ground. I got a great deal of inspiration early on from my late brother, who was a concert pianist, and he wrote me this note once because I had always done his posters and his graphics for him, sort of as a way of staying up with his emerging career. And he had let himself go and forgot to write me, and so he tried to make a poster, and he sent me the results, which were amusing. But the better part of that was his notion. He said, "I never understood what a blank page was until I stood there and said, 'God, where do I start?'" And that's, of course, something that those of us who supposedly had it before we went to architecture school probably didn't experience consciously. We've been filling blank pages for a long time with whatever we thought was important. And so the idea of working in a visual field was not something totally foreign. And I so we start. We start essentially trying to explain how something amounts to a visual field, how something goes into that visual field, and then how, once it's in there, we go about taking it apart. And we do that, of course, with an architectural bias, because, of course, we're talking about things that are going to relate to architecture in a very direct manner. Also, it's the only way to keep the book from being, you know, a 10,000-page magnum opus. And in that we lean on the language of Gestalt. It has its issues, but it's also the clearest language, regardless of its shaky grounds in some psychological circles. And of course, in this way, we also pay homage to Colin Rowe. In fact, Peter Eisenman as well, in trying to allow students to literally grapple with trying to make sense of an intentional mark, an intentional move that happens on a piece of paper, and to be able to see in that something that amounts to the possibility that could be a physical object in a real site. And getting that, starting from that really simple idea of getting folks to then see the sort of diagrammatic life of these drawings as being a way of, quote, end of quote, walking through the site, being able to have a metaphor of experience that's the equivalent of being able to hear a voice when you read a nice piece of writing. To actually literally have that sort of synesthetic merger of what you see on a page with what you hear in your mind, so that getting them to direct their attention to that very simple psychological game of seeing into something else, that is to look at a drawing and see something that is manifest as form. To literally see the page pop and become volumetric, because up until that point, all the pattern making in the world is only half useful. What's really important is the tension between the diagram, the drawing, the representation, and what it is you're trying to see that you're going to predict this going to be built. The third chapter is really amounts to the first 4 days of our class, highly articulated, right? And which is leading folks to just see a basic threat that happens in drawing, which is figure ground. So that you not only see the figure, but you see the ground, you see the negative space, you see, you know, all of those things that the visually alert take for granted and do without thinking. And making that game something that's apparent. It's a little bit like what happens to a sports fan, and I'm not a sports fan, but they become very expert at not only just seeing whatever physical activity is going on, but they actually compose in their mind this sort of meta-entity called the game, you know, where somebody is trying to do something and either succeeds or fails at it. In a sense, they see a conceptual diagram, a mapping, a sort of outline of the action, and separate that from the actual action themselves. You know, at the point that they get really good at that, they could coach, because it is that meta sense of being able to see the game at work that has to happen first. And in the first half of the book, we walk in a very, very careful way through a sort of increasing complexity of a sort of architectural reality. Although there's no scale to the first event, I can imagine someone else doing it with scale, but for us, it's really looking at it as a scaleless thing in which you inhabit it with your mind, where the students draw and then they model and then they draw and then they diagram and then they model and they go back and forth, and all our discussions lead off with, you know, with questions that really bring to the surface what they're learning to do. They're learning to be able to sort of conflate their models with their drawings, their diagrams with their drawings, mm-hmm. all of that stuff, and build up a kind of emerging workable consciousness. We're at the 6-week period in the semester as we yeah. speak, and I was talking to my own little section of 15 students, and you know, there's a lot of head nodding going on. They know they're in the game now, and this is a good point, right? But it takes a while, you know. It takes a while for at that point, then they can start to assemble an appreciation that is based on their own personal experience. They are able to see in projects, including their own, things that could be different, whether that's right or wrong. And then we've sort of succeeded as teachers, because we've got their interest and their...
So it's about a capacity to articulate.
Yeah, and they do. They get, all of a sudden, they can talk about it. I mean, we had a really nice class with everybody, all 60 students in the room, having an open discussion, as one of our colleagues flashed images with the question, is this an axis or a path? And, you know, to see a bunch of 18-year-olds like get real excited about taking a position it's fun. You know, you go, all right, you know, they may be naive. They may not know a whole lot, but that they're starting to look for the right stuff. And I think that, you know, we feel in first year a lot that, you know, at the end of the first year, that's what we've done. We've taught them to look for the right stuff and given them some good manual tools that are intimate with those questions. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Jeff, do you want to say something also about the structure of the book?
Well, yeah, as I think Michael's largely pointed out, that there's a master structure in terms of the organization of chapter to chapter, and that in one sense, I guess big picture would be that there's an introduction section, there's an introductory section of the first few chapters, the next several chapters provide an overview for the curriculum that leads from basic pattern recognition ultimately through a kind of fairly complex articulation of three-dimensional architectonic space. That leads to a pair of chapters 8 and 9, which lead through sort of case studies that diagram projects by architects, well-known case studies that we work through those case study projects in a very specific way that articulate a set of diagrams that define an analysis of those projects. In Chapter 8, the two projects that we look at are specifically chosen because they exemplify two-dimensional
architectural analysis. And chapter 9, we look at two projects that are more fully realized as three-dimensional entities. And finally, both because Michael, as a painter, is a very excellent painter, and because of the nature of the publishing business, we were given the luxury of having a certain number of pages in color. And so we opted to put them all at the back and organize them around a chapter devoted to color and color theory. And so that's the final chapter, chapter 10. So these are our 10 books on architecture, as it were. but each chapter, there's a sort of micro structure within each chapter. And so there's the main body of each chapter, the main essay. There are a series of examples that we organize towards the back, a kind of that act as an addendum. And then within most of the chapters, this is sort of case study essay. And that's, you alluded to the fact that there is a sort of sliver of history within each of the chapters. And that was one of the roles that I undertook. So there's a sort of, there's this little sort of dessert at the end of each chapter that uses examples from history. They're a bit more narrative in nature. And the role that those little miniature essays was designed to play was to try and embed the very abstract nature of the initial discussions, you know, the very geometric abstract pattern processes that we begin with, and to try to embed them in very concrete case study precedents, and to try and instill the idea in the students reading this book that we may be describing very abstract, geometric, pristine principles, but these are at the core of the most sort of tangible, earthy aspects of architecture. And so the very first example of this in chapter one, at the end of chapter one, describes the act of measurement as being absolutely fundamental to architecture and how it lies at the very origins of architecture. And then it's a very, you know, it's a very tangible and physical act, the act of measurement. Geometry is, in the end, embedded within a very physical act, the act of laying out the ground. And so that description exemplifies the sort of internal structure of the chapters that then is played out across a larger structure that describes the nature of the organization of the chapters as a whole.
And at the end of the introduction, you give a little set of definitions, and all the chapters have them as well, but there's a definition in the introduction for archetype. And as you were talking about the way that history functions in the book, I was thinking that one thing that you're teaching the students are that there are these archetypes that constantly appear and reappear. And as you say in your definition, it's an ideal form that existing things approach but never duplicate, and that the diagram somehow distills for us from buildings of any time period, really, some aspect of those archetypes that we're always duplicating and never really copying, if that makes sense. And I think it's so important for architecture students to understand that, you know, as a historian, somebody who teaches the design students both design and also history, I'm constantly trying to get them to see that history is not something separate from them and is not something useless, but is in fact the embodiment of that whole idea of the archetype, the kind of repetition of these core compositions and core spatial ideals that people have been thinking about for thousands and thousands of years. And a diagram of Hadrian's Villa is in some sense just as useful as a diagram of the Getty Center in Los Angeles, even though they may feel formally or stylistically more connected to something like the Getty or any other example we can think of. And so history plays a very active role in design in a way that a lot of students, when they first arrive, don't really see it. And I think the diagram is a really wonderful way to link those. And I really appreciate in the book that you worked hard to do that, that it's not a total abstraction, but in fact, this is a tool for building the knowledge base that includes history.
Yeah.
Yeah, and of course, we're inspired. I teach a writing seminar that we give as a sort of gen ed substitute for the second year students. And one of the essays that we always have the students read, of course, is Rowe's Mathematics of the Ideal Villa, where he compares a diagram of Palladian villa and a Corbusian villa. And the students are always astonished when they first see the side-by-side comparison, because, of course, initially they look at a Palladian villa and Corb's villa, and they see nothing in common. But when they see the diagram that Rowe has made of the two villas, they see that there is this similarity in a diagrammatic sense between the plans of the two villas. And the essay is a sort of unpacking of how there are these underlying themes. Now, you know, some have contested that as a solid analysis, but it does serve as a starting point. And in a sense, as Michael mentioned earlier, Rowe, Eisenman, others who have sort of played that game have, you know, served as inspiration for the way that we've looked at the work that was ahead of us in this book.
Yeah, so now I want to ask you a hard question a little bit that relates to this
sure.
issue, because as I was looking through it, I was thinking about the current debates about the global within architecture and the ways in which the canon is good and bad for us as architectural educators. And there's two aspects of this that I want you guys to talk about. And I challenge you to talk about it partly because I think it's important to discuss it, but also I'm curious to hear your opinion on it. And that is that you've chosen your examples from fully within the Western architectural canon, and you've chosen buildings that at least the teachers are all going to be very familiar with. And there's not a lot of challenge to, you know, what's in or out in terms of importance, and everything is pretty Western. So that's one side of it. And then there's also this issue of formal analysis versus some kind of cultural contextual analysis. And you both know that architecture has been really moving toward this more cultural model of design. And I think what your book does is reminds us, and something that I always need reminding of, that fundamentally, you know, architecture is a formal proposition, because we are always arranging things in compositions and in space. Whether those arrangements are culturally informed or not, there is still form. So I wonder if you guys could say something about the choice to use these kind of classics as your case studies, and also the critique that some people might have that your methods completely take the cultural context out of the discussion.
Well, this is Michael, and I will talk about it as the sort of formalist in the crowd, and also about my own pedagogical uptick on that. Part of the notion of using things that were familiar was so that the graphing of our ideas to architecture would be more easily done. That these are not esoteric projects. These are almost archetypes. If the majority of them are in the Western canon, I again only speak for myself, so am I. I personally distrust people who drop in like interested tourists and start making comments about other cultures. The way that I defend that is I think back to something that happened when I was a student. I was talking to Buford Pickens, who was this wonderful scholar of American architecture who also happened to be an architect. And Buford and I were having a discussion. I really loved him. I was his slide guy. I used to sit in the back of his class and push buttons for him. We were talking, and he looked at me with that sort of like tired look of that I probably have on my face, because he was about 65 at the time, and said, "Swisher." here's the deal. As soon as you put four walls around something, you have a courtyard. You have to see that. You have to understand it. All buildings start from that proposition. Now go away and think about it for a while. And it's safe to say that I've carried that around for some 40-odd years, that the defining of space, regardless of the cultural context or whatever political commentary, and I don't use that as a dismissive, but is still at play. And it's at play in all cultures. It's in play whether they're stuck in mud in a circle like our little project of the Banpo Hut, whether they're or they're the structure of Mises glass trying to make walls around a courtyard that's called the interior. And for me, when I would argue for the projects that we ended up doing, part of it was is we needed formal clarity or we would be writing another book. And if you look at the structure of our text, we have 1,200 images in there. This is called from, and this is not bragging, from about 6,000 that we use on a routine basis while we go about teaching the first and second semester of our program. And so part of this was, what do you edit out in order to be able to finish it all, in order to be able to have an articulate an articulate trail? There's a kind of compression that goes on through the text because we're trying to teach the basics. The first four chapters of the book, so that's roughly 80 pages out of 250, cover the first week in terms of the projects. The next two chapters cover the next 5 weeks. The next chapter covers another 5 weeks, and the final two chapters cover an entire semester. This is as a narrative, that was a real challenge, and I think that as tempting as all those other things were, I certainly have certain beliefs, and I know that Jeff does as well. I think that would have gotten in the way, would have muddied the waters. I'll take the criticism of being a Western person because I am. I operate inside of the Western canon because otherwise I would be insincere. I know that the Vedics came up with the Pythagorean theorem. I think that's great. I also think it's just an interesting piece of information. What matters is does that thing have any life right now? And part of the benefit of grabbing some of the canon is to grab some of the canon and make it work as an educational tool and not as a cultural tool. I would love to have someone who was, an architect in India look at this and tell me something that I missed or screwed up. But I certainly don't feel very good at being able to go, well, if I was a non-Western architect, well, would I look at this? I don't have that answer. It would be extreme hubris to pretend that I actually could concoct that. Now, that's my point of view. But it was not a matter of thinking it out as an intention as much as it was accepting it as a limitation of a book that's got 250 pages to do way too much. Jeff?
Well, as far as bias goes, I was working within my own limitations. Kimberly, as you know, I've taught a lot in Rome. Not only are the examples we've listed within the Western tradition, but you'll note, with few exceptions, that they're also very they're very focused on Rome itself, because they're examples that I know well. They're examples that I've seen and visited and have studied and have taught. So I was not aiming at a universal approach. I was aiming for examples that I was familiar enough with to be able to speak with something approaching authority. There were examples that were from non-Western traditions, but they were chosen because I felt that they were the most apt example that I could think of. As far as formal versus contextual, I agree, those are equally important. We teach first year. We have made a decision that before context comes a basic language of form. We're teaching compositional skills. If we were to do a follow up and teach a series based on how we might approach diagramming in second or third year, then certainly we would tackle the issue of how to diagram attributes and issues inherent to architecture beyond a basic language of form. But the focus in this book in no way suggests that form is more important than context or any of the other issues that are equally valid. So that's my account for the biases that are present in the book.
Can I add one more thing?
Yeah, sure.
So you, one of the other things that we did when we were discussing our choices is we made choices that everybody thinks they know, but for which no really accurate drawings existed. And we had to redraw everything and had to actually find out what sizes things were from two and three sources. It was really surprising to me, for instance, and that there were no accurate drawings of the Danteum that were available. I mean, if we had flown to Rome and, say, given us the books, we probably could have gotten some pretty good measurements from them. But we had to go backwards and actually draw them according to the principles that were apparent in the visual information that was there. Similarly, there was no model of Mises' courtyard building, and so we actually had to build a model of the courtyard building. And MacArthur was doing the same thing actually at Washington University in St. Louis. We built our remeasuring of the Danteum measured his, our redrawing of Kahn's Exeter Library of all the floor plans were highly accurate, and if you superimpose them over almost all the published drawings. The published drawings are, well, they've been published one too many times and they're distorted. So it was nice to finally actually take four canonical buildings and make sure that within our text and our explanation, we hadn't borrowed the same old tired images and made sort of gestures at it. We actually took the time out to go and rework and rediscover exactly what was going on formally in there. It took a while. And I think that that's actually one of the nice things in the book is that, much like Simon Unwin's, recasting of the, Barcelona Pavilion in his book, 20 Buildings That Every Architect Ought to Know, he restored some of, Mises' logic, to the, in its availability to the general discourse, which, you know, beats the heck out of, the same tired photographs from 1935.
And I just want to make sure that you know that I'm asking you to talk about it because I think it's important to be explicit about this. And I actually applaud the choices that you made. And there's a reason that people tend to want to give lip service to the global, and, you know, NAAB and our accrediting organizations are really forcing us to somehow embody this idea that global is better. But if we take the argument that you're making in the book, which is that there are archetypes, that there's a language, that students need to start to learn the language before they can get to the higher levels of complexity, in some sense, it really doesn't matter what examples that you're using. And I think that the choice to use buildings that you know well or that are buildings that you feel have been important in your own architectural lives, and then also to make sure that you sort of embody them new by really looking at what they should be and redrawing them and building them, this is the best lesson I think we can give to the students. You know, if you're in China, you can have examples there that you feel are very meaningful and the methodology holds. And the same thing goes for the absolute most iconic building. And so I think, in fact, what you're doing is embodying this global notion in a completely different way, which is to say, if we believe that there is method to teaching architecture, if we believe that our students need to be global citizens who can go from place to place, we have to give them some tools. And this is not about the canon, this is about the tools. And so I'm asking you to talk about it because I think it needs to be said. I don't want to leave it as an undiscussed issue, because I think you can hold this up and say to people, you know, this is not about whether the examples are from Rome. This is about teaching our students to be able to be good designers.
I assumed you asked the question because it was sitting there like the elephant in the room.
I think some people might not want to talk about it.
There are other issues at work too, but I agree. I mean, if we were to ask one or two of our colleagues who have expertise in other parts of the world, then I would have the expectation that they would choose examples that they were more familiar with, because that they would then be able to draw the same lessons, and they would be able to extract those lessons and reveal them to the students based on their deep knowledge that is embedded within those projects, and that the students would then be able to carry those lessons to wherever they found them useful. I would love for someone to send me to China for a year, and I would study the Forbidden City. And there were a number of examples, that we considered that ultimately we had more examples than we could use. And Forbidden City, for instance, which is a masterpiece of axial planning, in the end, I couldn't spend enough time getting to know it well enough to be able to use it in a learned way that would doing a book for the first time is kind of scary, because you expose your own level of awareness about a subject in a way that is different than, you know, speaking in front of a group of students, and so you feel as if you really have to know what you're talking about when you're going to publish a book. And so that's, I think, in the end, why I won't speak for Michael, but I relied ultimately on examples that I knew deeply and that I felt I could extract, as you said, tools or principles that could be portable, that students could then take and apply, you know, and could find or could have application just about anywhere, universal application.
Mm-hmm. So we're coming to the end of our hour. So I just want to give each of you a chance to say anything else that you want to say. And I thank you both so much for taking the time to talk to us. So, you know, take a minute or two each and any kind of closing comments that you want to make.
Well, I'll speak first, and that'll give Jeff the chance to be the last voice. First of all, thank you for doing the interview, Kimberly. It was really pleasurable. I my hope is that folks will, of course, buy the book, but mostly that they'll argue with us. If in fact we're going to try and have this thing move forward, I think I'd like to know how it fails. From another point of view, what would make it a better target? What things got left in there that are too local to our own teaching, and which things seem to have a broader reach? Because that's something, again, I cannot imagine. I would really rely on commentary, because I would like more than anything else to have the chance to do a second edition and make it the broader text that it's trying to be, rather than the local reporting of two folks who are working real hard to do their job.
Well, I would follow up in the same vein, and I would say I would use the word discussion because I'm Canadian rather than argument. And there, I managed to finally get in a Canadian joke. The venue for that could be anywhere. Could be, you know, hopefully we'll have a chance to meet people who have taken the time to read the book, and we thank you for this opportunity. But a wonderful venue. I'm going to put a plug in here because I'm you know, we're past contributors and I'm a past co-chair of the Beginning Design Conference, the NCBDS, which this year is going to be held hosted by Temple University. Beginning Design Conference is a wonderful venue for people who are really interested in pedagogy. And it sounds as if we're only interested in people who teach design and first year, but that's not the case. And we've had a lot of historians come and talk about what they do and the way that they deliver history and the challenges that they face as well. And it's not limited, again, not just to architecture, but to anyone who teaches design. And that we have amazing discussions, both in a formal setting and also, you know, off the record. And I'm putting that plug in because, you know, a lot of people are really passionate about teaching, and I having venues for, you know, pushing the envelope, pushing things forward, developing ways of, you know, extending the discipline of teaching and making things, you know, less, I don't know, off the cuff, and really beginning to have substantive discussions about what is effective in terms of teaching design and other forms of knowledge within a design setting, design school setting. Anyway, that's where I hope that these discussions will happen. These were some of where some of the ideas for this book came about at the conferences like this. And so I'm hoping that anyone who's listened to this will be motivated perhaps to look up that conference, perhaps to submit something, and maybe we'll end up having a conversation at a future conference. So that's where I'll leave things. Thank you again, Kimberly. This is a wonderful opportunity.
Thanks so much, guys. You've been listening to an interview with Jeffrey Balmer and Michael Swisher, the authors of Diagramming the Big Idea, Methods for Architectural Composition, published by Routledge in 2012. I'm Kimberly Zarecourt, the host of New Books in Architecture. Thanks for listening, and join us soon for more interviews.